Like their protectee, the agents in the rib saw the squall line too late. They watched from about 200 yards away as the lineman was overtaken by a curtain of rain, obscuring it completely. The lightning and thunder were incessant. Scott had already pushed the throttles forward to get the rib closer to the lineman to steady her and help their chief. A large wave broke over the snub nose of the unsinkable inflatable, but they still shipped green water that cascaded down the vessel and around the steering console, knocking both of them off their feet. With no one at the wheel, the rib careened in an insane circle just as the wind shifted 90 degrees and partially lifted the rubber hull, almost flipping it airborne and upside down. Both agents hung on to the straps along the pontoons while the rib at full power continued to pound into the waves in wild, crazy eights. Bennett finally got to the wheel, reduced power, and tried to get his bearings. With the sheeting rain and the spray, visibility was less than 20 feet. With no landmarks and no shoreline visible, both agents were disoriented and didn't know where the DCIA's boat was. They checked the radar and saw a speck that could have been the lineman, and raced to it in the stinging rain to find instead a crab pot buoy that had broken loose and was bobbing in the waves. They still had no idea which way the lineman lay. They might as well have been in mid-ocean, and racing around could take them farther away. After 10 more minutes, the squall passed, and as the last of the fat drops pattered on the rubber hull of the rib, the sun came out. Half a mile in the distance, the lineman's white hull was visible through the water mist that still clung to the surface. The agents raced up to the lineman, which was still rolling madly, the fishing rod and reel sliding on the deck. There is nothing as ominous as an empty boat drifting on the water, mute testimony of a soul reclaimed by the sea. As a frantic Bennett radioed the Coast Guard, then called the security duty office at headquarters, Scott at full speed started a grid search downwind for any sign of the DCIA, who they knew did not wear a life jacket. They had been out of visual sight of the lineman for approximately 19 minutes, and there was no other boat within a mile of them. The foul weather had even driven the oyster boat into harbor. What followed was the usual 2 days of Coast Guard daylight searches by helicopters and crash boats, concentrating on the lower bay based on the estimated time of the accident and the prevailing ebb tide. Alex Larson's body was finally found on the third day, face down on a sandbar off Racehog Point on Pone Island, about 50 miles south of Kent Island. The FBI investigated the incident with the Coast Guard and both concluded that the DCIA had drowned as a result of a boating accident. When official news of the accident was released, President Putin, against the advice of Anton Gorelikov, called the U.S. president to express his sympathy at the loss of a dedicated professional, a committed public servant, and a man of honor. The Slavic mordancy in Putin's comments was lost on POTUS, who already was considering candidates to fill the DCIA position. As Gorelikov had presciently predicted, Vice Admiral Roland was on the president's shortlist of DCIA nominees. All that toadying to POTUS's vanity had paid off. She was an outsider, a brainy woman, and someone who believed in diplomatic solutions with coalition partners, rather than resorting to armed conflict at the drop of a hat. He looked to Admiral Roland to continue the reforms within CIA and diversity, promotion quotas, and frankly, fewer dirty tricks that only antagonized foreign governments. At Langley, relevant branches in the Operations Directorate tasked Russian and counterterrorist sources to determine whether there were any known plots to harm the director. Not even Diva had heard anything in the Kremlin, and she sent her condolences via a Moscow station officer to Benford, who was inconsolable. Simon confided to Forsyth that he suspected the Russians had engineered the boating accident, which was nothing less than a political assassination ordered by Putin. Benford summoned Hersey to ask him about short-range drones that could be fitted with an explosive payload, or aerosolized biological compounds, or even with a single 2.75-inch rocket. Maybe an infiltrated operator could fly a drone close enough to catch Putin outside during a fishing or hunting trip and avenge the DCIA. Hersey looked at the floor without saying anything until Forsyth told Benford to stop hallucinating and to concentrate on their more immediate problem, vetting the White House's 3 nominee candidates for DCIA, a triumvirate of progressive Washington insiders, none of whom was well disposed to the agency. "Maybe we should reconsider those drones," said Hersey, walking out the door. Three combat swimmers from Spetsnaz Wimpel Group 3, a unit based in Moscow and normally used by SVR to execute sensitive wet work assignments abroad, beatings, kidnappings, and assassinations, were not returned to their unit after an unspecified special assignment, but rather were reassigned to a naval infantry unit at the Northern Fleet's Bolshaya Lopatka naval base above the Arctic Circle, on the Kola Peninsula, 70 kilometers east of the sliver of Norway's northern border with Russia. The three troopers were given privileges to the officer's commissary on base and weekend passes to Murmansk once a month. They knew enough never to mention the Chesapeake Bay, especially since a goateed dandy in the Kremlin had warned them of the consequences of indiscretion. They had no desire to be residents of Upravleni Solovetskogo and Karelo-Murmansk ITL, the directorate of Solovki and Karelia-Murmansk camps, once gulags filled by Stalin, but now grim modern district prisons, albeit with the original 1935 plumbing. Striped bass a la Fiorentina. Sauté fish fillets in butter and oil until golden. Set aside. In a saucepan, sauté whole peeled tomatoes, anchovies, chopped garlic, chopped cilantro, capers, a splash of balsamic vinegar, and thinly sliced potatoes until potatoes are soft and sauce is thickened. Serve fish on a bed of sauce. Chapter 12. Merit to the Fatherland. The drowning death of DCIA Alex Larson devastated the CIA workforce, and the turnout of silent, numb employees at the service in front of the memorial wall of stars chiseled into the marble, representing CIA officers lost in the line of duty, was so large that the front lobby overflowed and hundreds of attendees had to watch on closed-circuit screens set up in the cafeteria. Simon Benford was convinced that the Kremlin had engineered the DCIA's death and continued tasking operational desks to canvas assets for any indication of Russian complicity in the matter. The shocking loss of the DCIA was compounded by another catastrophe, sudden and inexplicable arrests inside the Copperfin spy network. A score of recruited design engineers in the Oak Aerospace Consortium were suddenly arrested by the FSB, and interrogations were being held around the clock in an attempt to identify other network members. Only two assets continued sporadic reporting, and their messages were panicked and barely coherent. Copperfin couriers were able to exfiltrate a handful of agents, in one case an entire family, but an equal number were caught and arrested at the border. At last count, at least 12 sources did not respond to sign-of-life signals and were unaccounted for, their status unknown. Benford knew very well that this was the worst case in the running of a large network. The inexorable unraveling, the continuing interrogations, the desperate attempts to escape, the arrests, and ultimately the triumphant news releases from the Kremlin. Benford knew that the Copperfin meltdown was the work of Magnet, but based on the chaotic counterintelligence performance of the FSB, they were picking apart the network in fits and starts rather than in a complete roundup. Benford was convinced that the mole did not have direct access to Copperfin and had learned about the network incompletely and serendipitously. In the lexicon of spooks, Magnet had vacuumed up the information, an overheard conversation, whispered gossip, an intemperate aside, the contents of an inbox read upside down. Windfall collection that could not implicate the mole, and left the FSB free to act decisively. No bigot list, therefore, could be used to flush the traitor. "The trouble with running a mole hunt," said Benford to Gable and Forsyth, "is that you cannot announce it, or drag suspects in for CI interviews, or immediately begin combing through 100,000 computerized personnel files, or tap the phones and computers of likely candidates without approvals and warrants. You cannot brief a bunch of feebs whose immediate reaction is to get into a Black Crown Vic and interview suspects at home, asking them outright whether they are currently or have ever cooperated with a foreign power. They expect immediate compliance. It's a crime to lie to the FBI, after all." The cumulative effect of their blandishments, of course, is to alert the mole, who heads for the hills, resulting in a permanent resident visa from the Russian Ministry of Foreign Affairs and an FSB-provided high-rise apartment in Babushinsky District, from the shabby comfort of which the traitor can listen through the clapboard wall every Saturday night to his neighbor's fucking. "Now we have a new problem," said Forsythe. "Magnet apparently is getting around some more. He's hearing about secrets like Copperfin. He's disappearing into the woodwork."
"He's a fucking flaming cactus," said Gable. "The key is the goddamn railgun. Dommy told me Magnet has been in harness for 10 or 12 years. That's gotta be key. Who's on the railgun project that long?"
Benford swiveled in his chair. "We're running all the combos, but it could be someone who previously worked on that project, but no longer. Diva reported that Magnet is moving up to a policy job. That widens the field."
"Okay," said Gable. "But Domi mentioned that fancy pants guy in the Kremlin wants to handle Magnet solely by the New York illegal and take the case away from GRU goobers. With so much infighting, Domi may eventually find out Magnet's true name on a restricted list."
"We can't wait that long," said Benford. "We're hemorrhaging secrets."
"We may not have to.
There's a lot of intrigue going on in the Kremlin," said Forsythe. "Not like the years Brezhnev shit his diaper and they held him upright to sign the disarmament treaty. Diva says Gorelikov runs his own shop, is loyal to Putin, but does things his own way. He's gunning for the GRU. Diva is ripe for promotion. She's going to get that name."
Benford shook his head doubtfully.
"Dangerous territory for our girl with all these plots," said Gable. "Gotta keep an eye on her. She's running a little hot these days, temperamental-like. She needs replacement Shrak gear ASAP."
Benford groaned at that. "There is no replacement Shrak. Our inscrutable colleagues from China operations requested and received the last two available systems, which already are slave to satellites in geosynchronous orbit to cover the Asian theater. They would not give up either one of them. Their refusal was polite but implacable, which I believe once again proves my contention that operational offices acquire the cultural characteristics of their target countries. Quite inscrutable. The Shrak larder is now officially bare. The last time this happened, the Carter White House suggested we use HF radio and Morse code. The acting director just ordered that R&D for the next generation of Shrak be put on hold. He wants to divert the tech budget to launch satellites that calibrate global warming. Orders from the NSC.
"Are you fucking shitting me? Leave inside assets without COVCOM?" said Gable.
Benford ran his fingers through his already anarchic hair. "I am throwing histrionic fits at every leadership meeting, but the bureaucrats are unmoved and singularly focused on the 1 degree Fahrenheit change in global temperature since Charlemagne. Hershey is racking his brains on cobbling together some sort of emergency signaling gear, but as of today we've got nothing on the shelf for her."
"We will have to rely on personal meets for the time being," said Benford, wearing his February face.
Every person in the room knew that each time Moscow Station or any denied area station tried a personal meet, the probability of catastrophic flap and loss of agent rose to 90%. Opposition surveillance had to get it right only once, and your agent was dead. Russia, China, Cuba, North Korea, it didn't matter.
"Personal contact with Domi is coming up in 3 days," said Gable.
"They got a good operator to meet our girl?"
"Case officer named Ricky Walters," said Benford, reading off a cable from Moscow Station. "Looked him up, good on the streets, ice for nerves, likes the ladies, but no zipper trouble in Russia. He looks okay."
Gable grunted. "In her current pissed-off state, she's not going to be happy without COVCOM. Hope he doesn't try to get saucy with her," he said. "He'll start his return SDR with a kick in the nuts. She doesn't need another Romeo. Nash is pissing her off enough as it is."
"Tell me that's still not a problem, Nash and Diva," said Forsythe.
"They're fucking in love," said Gable, holding up his hands. I know, but if you fire Nash, Domi might flat out quit on us. She's in that frame of mind lately, so you tell me what's worse, them belly thumping or her quitting?"
"We may be able to put some space between those thumping bellies," said Benford. "The Aussies have a clam bake brewing in Hong Kong, and they think they might need a Russian speaker. If we send Nash, it'll keep him away from her for a while. We can only hope that an extended separation will result in atrophy of one or both of their libidos.
No one laughed.
"Christ, is there any good news? What about that illegal in New York?" said Forsythe.
"Everything's done," said Gable. "Hersey spritzed the phone and we wrapped it so Domi could load the dead drop in some crazy little 1805 Jewish cemetery on West 11th Street in the village. 30 moss-covered tombstones on a little triangle of land behind a peeling wall. You'd walk by it all day without seeing it. She put the package behind the middle headstone of 3 against the brick wall, tilts forward so she wedged the package down low. We left it alone, lots of apartment windows around. That gal could be watching the drop.
We'll give it some time to insulate Diva, then go up to New York with 50 UV flashlights and bag us an illegal," said Benford.
After New York City, even including Staten Island, feeling the energy and prosperity and freedom of America, Dominica had returned to Moscow, which in comparison she now found sluggish, gray, and sad. Back in her office, she attacked her inbox and read through the backlog of SVR Global Counterintelligence developments. Overseas resident Turi reported 3 separate recruitments in Venezuela, Indonesia, and Spain. The Signals Intelligence Agency, the FAO, had developed access to an encrypted military communications channel in the Baltics. The Residentura in Washington, D.C. reported the beginning of discreet developmental contact between an SVR intelligence officer operating under non-official business cover and a congresswoman from California. The legislator was showing herself to be amenable to a lucrative consulting contract on international development policy and multilateral foreign assistance. The Washington resident cautiously predicted that an eventual recruitment would be based on money. The representative had previously been implicated in a house banking scandal involving check kiting and was judged to be corrupt and venal. These were important intelligence tidbits, but she could not report them to Langley for lack of functioning SHRAC equipment. Last weekend, she had buried the SHRAC gear damaged in the fight with the street toughs in a hole in Vorontsovsky Park, 10 kilometers outside the ring road southeast of Moscow, on the forested grounds of the abandoned 18th-century neo-Renaissance Vorontsov-Bashkov Manor. It would be decades before the excavations for the high-rise developments inexorably spreading out from Moscow would reach this far, and by then the city might well be renamed Putingrad, with homeless zombies roaming the dystopian suburbs. By then she hoped she would be lying on a sun-drenched veranda somewhere tropical, sipping rum while Nate painted her toenails island pink and maybe, she dreamed, with a little girl at their feet chattering to her dolls in Russian and English. Would my children be senesthetes? What would Nate say after all these years of keeping the secret? Would we be happy together? Will it ever happen? Dominica instead minutely printed her report in pencil on both sides of 2 sheets of water-soluble paper. It would dissolve to mush instantly on contact with liquid, and rolled the sheets into a tight tube. She unscrewed the bottom of a clunky Russian Phuket brand thermos bottle and slid the paper into the narrow space between the interior glass vacuum chamber and the plastic outer case. In an emergency, throwing or whacking the thermos against a hard surface would shatter the inner glass chamber, flooding the space between the outer shell, rendering the paper the consistency of Ovsyanaya Kasha, Russian oatmeal. If you had to use this prehistoric destruction device, Nate had showed it to her in Finland, you already were probably stopped at the roadblock about to be carted off, but it was effective. The personal meet was in 2 days, and pray God they're sending someone smart. She fantasized it would be Nate coming out of the shadows to wrap her up and kiss her forever in the fog-shrouded woods. Then the inevitable courtly call from Gorelikov, welcome back, congratulations on the meet with Susan, and the president would see them this afternoon at his Novo-Ogoryovo residence outside Moscow in the Odintsovo district on the Rublyovo-Upanskoye highway. The yellow mansion, nestled among pines with its classical peaked facade and 4 Corinthian columns, seemed small and modest when compared with the regal apartments of the Kremlin. They were shown into a living room of pale blue with peach-colored satin curtains, sat at a small antique table, and listened to a clock ticking from a corner bookcase across the room. Anton Gorelikov was stylish as usual in a tailored dark suit and starched tape-stripe shirt. Delicate ceramic cufflinks in blue and green showed at his sleeves. The blue halo about his head and shoulders was like a diadem, and glowed in exultation. They were served tea in elegant Podstakaniki glasses emblazoned with the double-headed eagle of the new Russian Federation, ironically similar to the bygone imperial eagle of the Romanovs and the Tsar. Plus ça change, plus c'est la même chose, thought Domenica. The more things change, the more they stay the same. A young aide in a light blue suit stood against the wall near the door, eerily blending into the blue paneling like some color-adaptive rainforest lizard, so that only his face was visible and seemed to be floating in the air. Domenica reflected that disembodied heads floating in the air seemed normal in a Putin residence. The little gold and ormolu clock chimed 11, and at that instant the door opened and the president walked in. How does he do that? Thought Domenica. Was he outside the door, hand on the knob, waiting for that infernal clock to chime? Or was the clock connected to an unseen power source and made to chime as the president entered? Vladimir Putin was, as ever, dressed in a navy suit, white shirt, and trademark aquamarine tie. His blue halo, likewise, was pulsing with energy. Why shouldn't it be? He had consolidated his hold on Crimea and secured his Black Sea naval base. The rearguard action in eastern Ukraine kept Kiev off balance. Alliances with Damascus and Tehran were paying dividends politically, and he was a major player once again in the great game. Oil, munitions, uranium. Rosatom even owned 20% of America's mined uranium. And there was more. Aktivnye meroприятия. Active measures, political subversion, propaganda, media manipulation, forgeries, and assassination. Gorelikov's campaigns in Europe and the United States were shaking the trees of NATO, the EU, and those upstart pricks in the Baltics. That maniac Kadyrov kept Chechnya quiet, and his own presidential domestic approval rating was holding steady at 85%. Gorelikov was conceiving new mayhem, and Igorova was a new talent, a steady hand in the field. The president wondered how steady her hand would be in bed. He had checked, no husband or significant other, a former sparrow, and the resident expert in honey traps. He was sure Igorova would figure into his future plans, especially with his gift today. The president nodded to Gorelikov and Domenica and sat down. An aide put a square velvet box on the table in front of the president and read from a sheet of paper. Medal ordenia za zasluhy perid otechstvom, I stipeni, he bellowed. Medal for the Order for Merit to the Fatherland First Class, awarded to citizens of the Russian Federation for outstanding achievements in various fields of industry, construction, science, education, health, culture, transport, and other areas of work. Other areas of work, thought Domenica. The president opened the velvet box and stood. Domenica and Gorelikov also stood, and Putin presented the box to Gorelikov. Nestled on a bed of blue satin was a starched claret ribbon with a tooled hanging gold medallion with the ubiquitous double eagle. Order for merit to the fatherland. Putin stepped up and pinned a small red ribbon bisected by a single yellow stripe to the lapel of Gorelikov's suit. Gorelikov bowed slightly and shook the president's hand. The aide unobtrusively reached over and took the velvet box, softly snapped the lid shut, and left the room. In the nature of commendations for clandestine missions, the award would be stored in the Kremlin. Gorelikov would not be allowed to hang the medal in his office or take it home. All he could do was finger the rosette in his lapel and bask in the knowledge of his accomplishment. The planning for the Rapina operation was flawless, its execution precise, the results exceedingly satisfactory, said Putin. Gorelikov bowed again, slightly. Thank you, Mr. President, he said. Domenica's mind reeled. The Rapina operation, what is this? Was she assaulted or simply framed in some false scandal? Then she knew. Blokhin. That's why he came to New York. Rapina was getting too loud, raising too much money, and attracting too much attention. She's gone. This was a crushing shock, to find out a full 2 days after the act. She had been traveling the entire day after and hadn't seen any news reports. Perhaps the New York authorities had held the news of the murder for a day. And it was no mystery that the assassination was not mentioned in the SVR news roundups stacked in her Lion KR inbox. What would they say? We report the unfortunate demise of activist Daria Rupina, who passed away from unspecified causes in New York City once again, exposing the unchecked violence in American cities and the lawlessness inherent in American culture. The news would break in Moscow soon enough, but Putin's control of the internet and television would distort the reporting, and the Moscow militia would disperse mourners before serious demonstrations could coalesce, while Putin sanctimoniously called for bogus investigations. Dominika swayed on her feet, telling herself to stay in control, to remain impassive. She felt faint and pinched her wrist to clear her head. She did not have to obsequiously applaud this kind of murder, but neither could she show revulsion, which would be considered a fatal weakness. Gorelikov was speaking again, and Dominika forced herself to concentrate. They had killed Rupina. I must highlight that Colonel Igorova's performance in support of the magnet operation was brilliant. Without her operational acumen, we would not be congratulating ourselves. I commend her highly. Dominika could see only the lanky body of Daria Rupina on the stage, pacing back and forth, railing internally against this man, with a wry smile of satisfaction on his face, standing a meter from her. I am aware of Colonel Igorova's performance and contribution, said Putin. Her diligence is constant affirmation of my decision to appoint her chief of counterintelligence in SVR. I am confident that she will attain to the directorship of the service. He looked slyly at Dominika, judging her reaction to essentially being told that she one day would be director. She nodded her head in thanks. You bastard. Putin was pleased. Gorelikov was pleased. Benford would be pleased. Thank you, Mr. President, said Dominika, fighting to conceal her rage. I will try to continue to be worthy of your trust. Such verbal pap, thought Dominika, the Russian version of small dogs lying flat in the presence of an alpha dog. But Zlody, you hellkite, you do not know that I am inside your house to bring it down, to rid the Rodina of you. What do you think of that? Can you read my thoughts? As if he had heard, Putin gave her his trademark watery smile, like slivers of ice and warm beer. I have designated a dacha on the compound at Cape Idokopas for your exclusive use. The weather on the coast is mild well into October. Through her fury, she was caught unawares. It was something. Even as Dominika thanked the president anew, she calculated furiously. A gozdacha was a state-owned vacation home on a lake or river, or in the cool piney forest parceled out to functionaries to reward diligence, productivity, or loyalty. This particular dacha, however, was more than a three-room birch plank cottage with a garden plot outside Nizhny Novgorod. This was one of the luxury hillside concrete villas within Putin's 70-hectare complex on the Black Sea coast, on wooded Cape Idokopas. The presidential residence there, an Italianate chateau as big as Buckingham Palace, was said to cost $1 billion. Being given this sort of dacha on this particular compound signaled patronage on a grand scale. Dominika knew this was all a sticky spiderweb. Gorelikov's medal was presented to him today, with her present for two reasons. Putin was establishing that Gorelikov was senior, and that men gave important medals to other men, a Slavic reminder of her subordinate gender. Everyone knew the president greatly preferred the company of men. The Siloviki comprised only men, but Igorova was edging toward becoming a potential insider. The second reason was this was a medal for eliminating a dissident. A look inside the furnace. Kill as I command and you will be rewarded. There was still another nuance. Though a handsome reward, the villa carried with it the hint of setting up one's mistress in her own residence, connected to the master's manor by a secret garden path. As the Leshva Zhena, the left-hand wife, you are expected to be ready for the Tsar bathed and perfumed on satin pillows, your ruby fruit wet and swollen, waiting for the discreet scratching on the garden door day or night. He expected her to be his left-hand wife. Domenica swallowed the familiar rage in her gut that joined the anguish in her heart for Rapina. All the villas and all the ribbons in the world could not lessen what this queer little blonde schemer was doing to her Russia, as citizens waited for their delinquent pension checks to buy bread. Putin and his inner circle had starved the country. Does this include me? Am I now a Silovik, wondered Domenica, as a luxury dacha recipient? And no end in sight, she thought, to this corruption, and no end in sight to my life as a spy. She wondered whether General Korchnoi had felt the same, committed to this mortally dangerous work, strangely fueled by midnight adrenaline, yet trapped with no way out. God, how she needed Nate right now. This all skittered through her mind in a second. Putin was saying something, and she struggled to focus. We must now wait for fortune to smile on Magnet, said Putin. In the meantime, Colonel, I want you to renew the liaison relationship with the Chinese MSS general. What is his name? General Sun, said Domenica. He claims his service has a counterintelligence problem, and they want our assistance. I don't trust him at all. See what he has under his fingernails. Find out what he wants from us. We don't need any surprises from Beijing. Menshez naesh krepshe spish, said the president. The less you know, the more soundly you sleep. Yes, Mr. President, said Domenica. And now lunch, said Putin. He led the way down a parquet-floored corridor with white walls picked out in gold leaf, and onto a broad sunny terrace, ringed by a heavy white balustrade. At the center of the terrace, under a billowing canopy, was a table set for three, with sparkling crystal and elegant plates with blue and gold borders. On each plate was a ramekin swaddled in a nest of snowy linen. Domenica could smell the heavenly aroma of crab meat and imperial sauce. The tops of each ramekin were baked golden brown, and the sauce still bubbled around the edges. "Crab imperial," said Gorelikov. "Marvelous. We used to eat this in Odessa as students." "Try a forkful and see if this is not better," said Putin. The delicate crab meat melted in Domenica's mouth. An ice-cold vernaccia was the perfect wine, and she accepted a second glass. But the image of Darya Rapina floated in front of her. The sun went behind a cloud, and the piquant imperial sauce in her mouth turned to copper. Domenica would add this news about the murder to her thermos concealment for tomorrow's personal meeting, but she would withhold Blokin's name. He was hers, and she vowed to kill Sergeant Josip Blokin herself some day. "Didn't I tell you the president had his eye on you?" said Gorelikov in the official car back to Moscow. Domenica smiled. "It is quite an honor." "I can hardly believe it," said Domenica. "And congratulations on your award." Gorelikov bowed graciously. "I was a bit surprised to hear about Rapina, though," said Domenica. "What actually happened?" "You could have told me, Anton, seeing as how I was meeting Susan." Gorelikov waved her comment away. "Rapina was beginning to embarrass the Russian Federation, the Russian people, and the president," said Gorelikov. "We previously sent emissaries discreetly requesting that she moderate her activities and manifestos. She chose to ignore those requests. So Blokin was assigned to eliminate her, in America, in Midtown, New York City. What would have happened if there had been a mishap? This is bad operational security. I should have been warned, really." Gorelikov patted her hand on the center armrest. "Shlikov guaranteed that there are seldom mishaps when Blokin is assigned a mission," said Gorelikov. "Besides, I did not want you burdened with the foreknowledge of the impending action. You sound upset that Rapina was dealt with," he said. "Tread softly here, but show a little flag," thought Domenica. "I have scant sympathy with citizens who would harm our country," lied Domenica. "But I will tell you something, Anton. If I had known of the plan to assassinate Rapina, I would have tried to disrupt the plot. Russia is skilled and ingenious in achieving its goals, and no one more so than the president himself, but destroying dissidents sullies the Federation and makes them enduring martyrs. We must abandon the old ways. Gorelikov looked at her, then turned to stare out the car window.
I happen to agree with you, he whispered, but the president knows his mind and has the requisite experience. I have mentioned to him the exact views you have just expressed, and he realizes the cost and is willing to pay the price.
Как окнется, так и откликнется.
What you shout into the forest, so shall the echo come back to you.
Gorelikov called Dominika back to the Kremlin the next day, ostensibly to backbench a meeting of the Security Council, but in reality, to introduce her to the most powerful men in the realm, a coming-out appearance for the soon-to-be SVR director. These Siloviki could be potential allies or, if their interests diverged, lethal adversaries. They all obviously respected Gorelikov and wondered whether Dominika was more than a rising SVR star, or merely the new pintle maid of the president. To a man, they dropped their eyes to assess her jutting top hamper, today draped in a black wool-knit dress which accentuated her curves. First, there was Nikolai Petrushev, former director of the FSB, now influential secretary of the Security Council, with thinning hair, a lined narrow face, a slash of a mouth, and the hook nose of a Cossack, all backlighted by a yellow halo of cunning and distrust. He was marginally polite before turning away. Dangerous. Then Alexander Bortnikov, with the surprising cerulean halo, strong and constant, suggesting ratiocination and regard. The FSB director was 65 years old, slight, and shorter than Dominika. He had a high, broad forehead and startling gray-blue eyes that crinkled at the corners whenever he smiled. He had a large mole on his left cheek and a fleshy nose, a hint of the raptor in him. Dominika knew he was an engineer by training, and it was whispered that it was he who had directed the FSB operation in London to spike dissident former KGB officer Litvinenko's afternoon tea with enough lethal polonium-210 to heat an apartment block in Voronezh for a month. Dominika knew Bortnikov would be wise, sly, cautious, and cunning. He also would be her security service counterpart for internal domestic security if Dominika was handed the directorship and SVR's foreign intelligence portfolio. She resolved to establish good relations with him. Finally, there was Igor Korobov, an Air Force lieutenant general and chief of the GRU, crisply uniformed, with a shaven head, steel-blue eyes, and the green aura of career trepidation from being head of military intelligence in a club of former KGB cohorts. Major Shlikov hovered behind Korobov, doubtless currying favor by kneading his chief's buttocks periodically. Korobov nodded stiffly at Dominika, but Shlikov ignored her.
You tried to torpedo me in New York, you bastard, she thought. Worse, you sicked Blokin on me. He would have left me in some alley after eliminating Rapina if he'd had the chance.
She measured the inches from his smirking face. Gorelikov stepped between them before Dominika could put her thumbnail in Shlikov's eye and whispered for her to take a seat against the wall behind him, as Putin gaveled the council to order. For the next utterly unreal 2 hours, the council discussed Operation Obval, Landslide, which was conceived, refined, planned, and proposed by Shlikov, who guaranteed success and stunning results. The covert action whereby Russian weapons and explosives would be smuggled to Kurdish guerrilla separatists to be used in terror attacks in Istanbul to destabilize Turkey was a massive active measure on the extreme end of the scale. Gorelikov and Bortnikov opposed the plan, both pointing out that the military aspect was exceptionally risky and that such a supply the rebels with guns operation was laughably 1960s Soviet primitive. Bortnikov called it a reckless misadventure, all the more so in Turkey with its vigilant and aggressive police and security services. Lieutenant General Korobov disagreed, saying this insurgency would destabilize the southern flank of NATO, a theme he knew, all of them knew, would gain the president's favor. Which way would it go? Dominika saw Putin looking at her down the length of the chamber table. What was she going to do if the Pale Moth, one of the president's old KGB nicknames, tried to hoist a leg over her one night in her luxury dacha? Then, it happened. Gorelikov leaned back toward her and whispered, "What do you think?"
"Yes, Colonel," said Putin from the head of the table. "What do you think of Obval?"
20 faces turned to look at her. Bozhe moi, mother of God, she thought. She looked around the table, then directly at Shlikov, sitting behind his chief.
"Strich porosenk," she said.
"Like shearing a pig. Lots of screaming, but very little wool. A fool's errand, and one countered easily by Turkey and the United States. Especially when I alert Benford." There were guffaws around the table, and Wily Bortnikov of the FSB appraised her anew. Gorelikov was delighted. The GRU contingent sat sullenly. Putin sat with his hands folded, his Stonehenge face impassive. Dominika realized she was being drawn into her first Kremlin intrigue. Gorelikov intended to usurp the magnet case, and Shlikov had to be brushed aside. Discrediting his paramilitary scheme in Istanbul was a start. Dominika studied the patrician Anton, saw his blue halo pulse, and read his mind. Why bring her into this? Because as counterintelligence chief of Line KR, Dominika could credibly criticize Shlikov's tradecraft, operational planning, and judgment if there was a flap. Gorelikov knew Dominika would line up on his side. He knew Shlikov's boorish and dismissive attitude had made him an opponent. Oh, this was how quickly sides were drawn up in these jeweled hallways. Allies, competitors, self-interest, personal grudges, career traps, and blood feuds. These were the swirling mosaic politics of the Kremlin.
"Do these chiefs know about the magnet and academician Rhee cases?" Dominika asked Gorelikov when they were alone.
She would meet Rhee in 10 days. Ioana was already in Vienna preparing the Danube cottage. Dominika reminded Gorelikov that they'd have to prioritize cases, hoping to elicit a name for Magnet, but Anton was cautious.
"No one knows about Magnet besides GRU, and we won't disseminate it, not yet, especially not after recent developments. In time, a few members of the Security Council will be briefed, but not all of them."
"What developments?"
"We received a report from Susan last night. Magnet is being looked at by the U.S. President to become part of his administration. Nothing specific, but it is unprecedented. The candidate Kremlevskogo, the Kremlin's candidate in Washington. Magnet may be offered something important. We will wait patiently and see what our harvest will be."
"Will you brief me eventually on Magnet, or shouldn't I ask?"
"Be direct, confidential, a little piquant. That's what he likes."
"Of course, once the case stabilizes," said Gorelikov, tickled at her pluck. "The president agrees completely. Magnet is a political case now, a director's case, one he once handled only by an illegals officer, not you, not me, only Susan, period." Gorelikov had just given her the lead to the extra pages she would have to prepare for tomorrow's personal meeting with a Moscow station officer. Magnet, the Kremlin's candidate. Dominika mentally drafted the additional intel. Vienna meeting with Rhee, her new black sea dacha, the Rapina assassination, Shlikov's urban terror plot in Istanbul, Gorelikov's prediction that she would be given the directorship of SVR. She was going to need a bigger thermos bottle. Dominika was unsettled. This was too much. Putin was like a raging Siberian blizzard boiling across the steppes, headed for the little cabin, a blizzard whose icy fingers would work their way under the eaves, pry up the roof, splinter the bolted door, and collapse the walls to devour the huddled beings inside.
"Bergitas, beware, Benford. The blizzard is approaching."
Putin's Crab Imperial. Combine diced red bell pepper, minced parsley, lemon juice, raw egg, mustard powder, paprika, celery salt, bay leaf, black pepper, red pepper flakes, Worcestershire sauce, mayonnaise, and melted butter in a bowl and whisk until smooth. Gently fold in lump crab meat, spoon into ramekins, and bake in a medium-high oven until bubbly. In a separate bowl, make imperial sauce by whisking mayonnaise, light cream, lemon juice, and Worcestershire sauce.
Top each ramekin with imperial sauce, butter-moistened breadcrumbs, and paprika, and place under broiler until golden brown. Serve with a green salad. Chapter 13. Natural Enemies. Ricky Walters hated climbing into the trunk of a car, swaddled in a crinkly silver space blanket, knees bent to fit inside the space, his butt hard against the spare tire. The sweat would start almost immediately, partly nerves and partly from trapped body heat. 3 years ago, a defector told his CIA debriefers that the FSB, in lookout apartments across the street, scanned the cars of U.S. diplomats leaving the Moscow embassy compound from above with infrared scopes to determine if there was a glowing heat source in the trunk, which would indicate a hiding CIA officer, who else, the knife and fork set in the Department of State, wouldn't be caught dead playing these cops and robbers games, was trying a trunk escape to get black to meet a Russian agent and steal national secrets, of which there were as many in Putinstan as there had been in the cave bear days of the Soviet Union. The space blanket trapped the body heat, and through an IR scope, the trunk looked cold and empty. In mid-afternoon, Walters was driven out of the underground garage in the trunk of the Honda sedan of the junior consular officer, a station colleague, by that officer's 27-year-old wife, Helen, who had herself received months of training in surveillance detection. The couple's 2-year-old twins were chattering away in rear car seats as Helen watched her mirrors through multiple turns as she headed for Smolensky Passage Mall in the Arbat, a glitzy collection of shops affordable only to the lithe wives of oligarchs and the less lithe, thick-ankled wives of government ministers and heads of industries who found their positions provided gratifying amounts of disposable income skimmed from the official coffers of the state. A last check for the telltale trailing Lada 2 blocks back. Negative. She was totally clear of ticks this afternoon. And Helen entered the ramp to the underground parking garage, punching the twins' favorite music disc, Rafi singing about the wheels on the bus going round and round, to which the twins resoundingly joined in. The more noise for the FSB-planted microphone in the car, the better, and which was also the ready signal to Ricky listening from the trunk. Helen rounded the corner of the ramp, totally screened in the gap, ejected the disc, go signal, to howls from the twins, popped the trunk, and pulled on the emergency brake handle to slow the car without showing brake lights. Ricky shed the blanket, rolled over the lip of the trunk, slammed the lid, and darted through a service door, up a short staircase and out into the street. Elapsed time, 4 seconds. Helen smoothly continued down to park and browse the stores, pushing a 2-seat stroller. On the street, Ricky wore a Soviet-style cloth cap, dirty whipcord trousers, a padded light jacket torn at the shoulder, and a pair of scuffed Duolang acid-resistant safety shoes imported from China. As he walked head down, he wedged silicone spacers between his gums and cheeks and slipped on clear-lens eyeglasses, making himself look older and heavier. He cleared the ritzy Arbat neighborhood, entered Kamovniki district, and walked slowly along Ostozhnanka Ulitsa, a broad commercial street. Halfway down the boulevard, Walters loitered at a bright red public phone sidewalk kiosk and checked his watch. The standard 4-minute window was just opening, and Walters saw the little dusty navy Skoda hatchback approach and pull over to the curb, a box of tissues on the dash. All clear. Ricky lifted the red phone off the cradle and put it back. Clear here. He scooted to the car and got into the passenger seat, scrunching down just enough to mask his profile, and the car moved off. He felt the plastic cover on the seat, a precaution against spy dust, though his Ruski disguise clothes had been kept in the station and were unlikely to be contaminated. This was an agent car pickup, substantially dangerous because a recognizable CIA officer was in the agent's vehicle, the license plates of which were as good as her name being printed in block letters on the side of the car. The reverse procedure, a case officer car pickup, was generally preferred, but there was still risk. Now you had a sensitive source in a U.S. diplomatic-plated vehicle. "Pick your poison," Gable once told Nash in Dominica during tradecraft practice. "Doesn't matter who drives and who gets picked up. Just fucking get there, black, both of you. That's all there is to it."
Walters looked over at Diva, who his chief had told him last night was the absolute gold standard, so don't make any mistakes, not one, because if he screwed this one through tradecraft error, he'd be muscling a floor buffer in the headquarters front lobby, making sure the great seal of CIA on the terrazzo marble floor was nice and shiny for when his replacement reported for duty. No pressure, mind you, and have fun out there. Walters didn't know what to expect, a mousy librarian or a rotund administrator, but not this Venus driving the car, not the classic Hellenic profile, flower petal lips, luminous chestnut hair piled on top of her head, concentrating on traffic, electric blue eyes darting constantly between her mirrors. Her elegant hands held the steering wheel professionally at the 10-2 position, and she moved through traffic aggressively, shifting smoothly out of the district, east onto the third ring road, weaving through the belching blue traffic, then suddenly off again on Leosinovskaya Ulitsa, south to the 390-hectare Kolomenskoye Park on the river. Diva parked, and then they quickly walked through crowds of tourists, no one paid them any attention, past the bone-white Church of the Ascension and the fanciful 17th-century wooden palace of Tsar Alexei, bristling with gables, onion domes, and bell towers. Diva led Ricky down a steep wooded slope to a small stream bed, mossy paths following the water, surrounded by thick woods. It was suddenly dark and cold and utterly silent. A slight mist hung over the trickle of water, and Walters looked around for three hags stirring a bubbling witch's cauldron. Ricky knew they could spend more than the requisite 4 minutes in this creepy wooded glen for the meeting. Good screening.
"Pretty spooky down here," said Walters in English. He had no Russian. "We could probably find a couple of long-term cache sites somewhere along here."
"Golosov Ravine," said Diva, looking around. "It's very famous to Muscovites. There are sacred stones, holy natural springs, and tales of phantoms appearing out of the fog. Thank you for coming. No problem getting clear?" "The CIA boy looks smart, he's calm, and handles himself well on the street. Not like Bratok, but solid."
Walters shook his head, unzipping his backpack, mentally reviewing his meeting agenda.
"Thank you, Colonel, for all you've done," said Walters. "I'm aware of only a fraction of your service, but enough to know what you contribute." A charmer like Nathaniel Nash, she thought. Same purple halo, too. Passionate. "Call me Dominica," she said. "Do you have my replacement equipment?"
She saw his face fall. He told her quickly about the Shrak situation, and said that Simon Benford was working to get camo gear to her as soon as possible. In the meantime, Mr. Benford wanted her to have this. He held out a chunky sports watch inside a plastic bag, a precaution against Metka.
"Are you people serious?" she said, carefully dipping into the bag, extracting then fingering the watch. Walters hurried to explain. "Without Shrak, we'll have to use personal meets or dead drops to pass intel and requirements. You know all the call-out signal sites, right?"
Dominica nodded.
"This is different. The watch is a beacon for emergencies. It's connected to something called the Kospas Sarsat rescue system, which is a maritime rescue locator with a GPS capability," said Walters. "The beacon frequency is encrypted and hops around. It looks like background noise to nearby receivers, no triangulation." "Quite lovely, but what is its purpose?"
Walters did not know about Dominica's militant opposition regarding exfiltration. "An exfil trigger? If you activate the beacon and we geolocate the signal in Moscow, we'll check every day at 2100 hours at the downtown pickup site," said Ricky, reading off a small tablet. "You remember it, the twin phones to the right of the Filevsky Park metro station entrance. It's less than a kilometer from your current apartment." Dominica nodded. "If we geolocate your beacon near Petersburg, we use Red Route 2. You know that site. If your beacon transmits from Cape Idokopas, which we have designated as the Black Sea exfil site, you wait on the beach for pickup."
"Exfiltration again? Another submarine?" asked Dominica, her voice suddenly edgy.
She had once rescued a blown CIA agent by delivering him to a mini-submersible crewed by Navy SEALs in Neva Bay, near Petersburg.
"No, there's something different," said Walters, sweating despite the dank air in the ravine. He swiped at the tablet. "A manned mini-submarine takes time to deploy and is slow.
We have something new that's always ready and very fast. You will be taken off the beach in a USV, an unmanned surface vessel. He showed her streaming images of a low-slung 50-foot flush-deck speedboat painted gray overall, with wavy patterns of white and black camouflage. Dominica looked at Walters. You are telling me this boat has no one driving. There is no crew? Ricky swallowed hard. Gable had warned him that D.Va could quickly get in a horn-tossing mood. It is precisely computer-controlled, steered by satellite, undetectable on radar, can loiter indefinitely and is always available, said Walters. With this platform, maritime exfiltration from Putin's palace on the Black Sea becomes a viable option. I will only be at the Cape during the president's four-day reception this fall in November, so it is not a viable site, she said. Besides, Gospodin Benford knows my attitude regarding fleeing and defecting. Didn't he mention it to you? I'm sorry, I don't understand, said Walters, trying to keep this together. Agent handling, more like playing a snake charmer's pungi flute in front of a swaying cobra. He hurriedly dug into his backpack for another plastic envelope. You wait on the shore night or day, and you wear these infrared sunglasses so you'll see the USV's IR strobe two clicks out at sea. Just stand there, and it'll home in to the wristwatch. The thing'll beach itself, glide up to you without a sound, like a horse nuzzling for a sugar cube. You climb up the tow holds on the stern, open the deck hatch, and get in. Watch your head. It's tight. There's a recliner-like chair, a seatbelt, headphones, food and drink, heat control. You close the hatch, and the USV will do the rest. He showed her more images. Where is this thing supposed to take me? At 50 knots, you'll be 20 miles offshore at the pickup point with a gray hull in 24 minutes, said Walters proudly. Where you gentlemen will greet me aboard the Navy ship, and we watch at the rail as we sail away and my Rodina sinks below the horizon forever, said Dominica dully. And I will have effectively deserted my country. Pissed off agent. Walters couldn't remember this precise situation coming up during role-playing exercises at the farm. He searched for the right words. It's an exfil plan, Colonel. I mean, Dominica. In case of hot pursuit, to get you to safety. She shook her head, finished with arguing, and handed Walters the thermos bottle. Walters wiped the thermos to get rid of D.Va's prints. There are 6 single-space double-sided printed sheets inside the shell. If you smash it to break... I know the thermos trick, Walters smiled. What more? Please tell Gospodin Benford I will be in Vienna in 10 days to meet with my North Korean. I will call to confirm my hotel that we have used the König von Ungarn on Schullerstrasse behind St. Stephen's previously. Please tell him I believe Professor Rhee will accept the introduction of an additional debriefer. We have done it before, with Mr. Nash impersonating a Russian officer, thanks to his Russian language. In this case, it would be easier as our meetings are conducted in English. CIA can service your own North Korean requirements without risk. Walters nodded. If you handle him in English, then any nuke analyst can... I would prefer the officer be Nathaniel Nash, interrupted Dominica. We have worked together for years and operate compatibly. Walters thumbed D.Va's request, demand, into his tablet, not knowing the phrase operate compatibly would result in knowing glances at headquarters, for he was unaware of the forbidden relationship. The woman was something. I'll pass the word, said Ricky. Dominica's face darkened and her voice became low and serious. Also, please tell him that I can confirm that President Putin approved the assassination of dissident Daria Rapina in New York City. That created panic in Washington, said Walters. It was all over the papers. Who did it? Never mind his name. I know who is responsible and I will deal with him, said Dominica. I'll tell them, said Ricky. This Amazon is serious. Look at that face. I suppose I should say for the record that you should not try any dangerous or risky action against the assassin. You're too valuable and...
And a frail woman? Said Dominica.
Walters held up his hands in armistice. His tablet, a second-generation Talon device, was recording their conversation. Standard procedure for restricted handling cases. When they play it back, I should get a medal if I get through this meeting without D.Va punching me in the face. That's not it at all, said Ricky, thinking furiously for the correct word. I just meant
You're too precious to us. Precious, fortuitous word. Diva's face softened. I do not mean to snap at you, she said in apology, then became serious again.